In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Welcome. So glad you're joining us today on the iSpy Radio Show as we continue every week to keep an eye on big government. Regular iSpy listeners are keenly aware that at the heart of big government lies big spending. So on today's show, we're talking economics and government spending. Now, before you change the dial, did you know that economic warfare and financial terrorism will be the weapons of choice in the 21st century? They are this century's nuclear bomb. Imagine bringing down another country without ever firing a shot. We'll talk about all that with Kevin Freeman, author of Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack, and one of the world's leading authorities on economic warfare and financial terrorism. And before you think that this is all fringe or conspiracy theory, did you know that these kinds of attacks have already happened? That there was an actual economic attack on our financial system in 2008 by an enemy country. How? By finding a weakness in our financial system and exploiting it. Again, more on that with Kevin Freeman. But that's how warfare works. You attack the weaknesses. And as you'll hear in today's show, big government is creating a massive vulnerability. Grant and aid funding is spending by the federal government given to states or local governments to fund a specific project or program. And these are programs that the feds would like to do, but there's that whole pesky Constitution thing that gets in the way from them just going out and doing it. This is not a loan and does not have to be repaid unless, well, we'll let Senator Doug Whitsitt talk about that. But more importantly, as you'll hear, it's creating a vulnerability in the system that can be exploited and attacked. And I'd like to welcome now Senator Doug Whitsitt from Senate District 28 to talk about the grant and aid funding situation. Senator, it's great to talk to you today.
Well, thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. You know, in my opener, I gave kind of the basic idea of what grant and aid funding is, but you know, has this grant and aid funding, has this always existed, or is it a recent phenomenon due to basically unchecked federal spending once we left the gold standard?
It's pretty much expanded almost exponentially since, I think in 1971, the entire federal grant and aid program was about $24 million. In this year, this fiscal year, 2014, it'll be almost $650 million.
Mm.
So in a period of, in 2 years, actually, we're all adding almost $1 trillion to our national debt through grant and aid programs.
And a lot of that, of course, is borrowed. We're basically allowing the Chinese and other foreign investors to pay for our overexpenditures. Has this grant and aid funding, does it differ from typical federal funding, or is it that just sort of a blanket term for federal expenditures within states?
The federal government is authorized by the Constitution to spend money on particular things. The federal government wants to spend money and wants to engage in rulemaking and lawmaking on a lot of different subjects. And so they use the grant and aid program to essentially bribe the states into allowing them to have their way with state government. As you know, the federal constitution is a federalist constitution. It was designed to divide the powers enumerated or listed to the federal government into three different branches, executive, legislative, and judiciary. But most important, it divided the powers into those that were given to the federal government, which are listed, and all other powers were left to the state governments, so and to the people. So there's a whole lot of things that the federal government does and wants to do that they are not authorized to do by the federal constitution. And so by creating these grant and aid programs, they are able to manipulate or bribe the governments of the states into doing what they want them to do.
And as far as this funding is concerned, does it typically or does it always require matching funds from the states, or are there other special strings attached to it?
Oh, each grant and aid program is different. I mean, some of them are just a straight out gift, as it were. Others require matching funds. Others require maintenance of effort. so that the state can't just use that fund. They have to not only use their own fund, but they have to continue to do what they were doing before. There's a lot of different ways to manipulate the state into doing what the federal government wants you to do. Many of these, of course, also come with the specific rules on how the money must be spent. And it often requires the state to enact regulations that the federal government wants enacted in order to access the grant programs.
Well, and in terms of that, you said that there are specific rules on how it must be spent. What happens then if those rules aren't followed? Does the state have to, is it just a matter of coming back into compliance? Are they in danger of losing the funds? What happens?
They're in danger of losing the funds, and they may, if they're not, if they don't follow the rules, they may have to refund the money. It's pretty simple. You go back to, like, the Columbia River crossing, for instance. One of the rules that had to be followed was a significant amount of the money had to be put into light rail across the river. And, of course, nobody much wanted the light rail, and that's one of the reasons, and one of the many reasons, that the program imploded. So you have not only the requirement for light rail, but the federal government provided a lot of money for the state of Washington and Oregon to plan this bridge. And since it's now not going to be built, it's very likely a great deal of that money is going to have to be returned to the federal government because we didn't follow the rules. We didn't build a bridge they wanted to be built.
Do you have any idea what that is likely to amount to?
It's in the tens of millions of dollars, I think, somewhere. And I don't have it on the top of my head, but if I recall, it was somewhere between $60 and $80 million, somewhere in that ballpark.
And, well, fortunately, Oregon is so flush with cash, we won't even feel that.
Right.
You know, as part of the process, as these grant and aid funding programs are put forward, where do they typically originate from? Is this basically, I hate to use the word scheme, but it seems to fit really well. Is this a scheme that starts at the federal level and then is pushed down to the states, or the states say, hey, we would like to do X, Y, Z. Can you come up with the funding for this?
No, it's primarily federal funded, and it is funded for the purpose of encouraging the states to enact rules and regulations that the federal government does not have the power to, does not have the constitutional power to enact. So they are enabling the states to enact those rules and regulations by giving them money.
And as part of that process, either at the federal or the state level, does anyone ever do a cost-benefit analysis to ensure that the assumed returns on the expenditure is either positive or at least break-even, or do they do any kind of financial analysis?
I've seen very little financial analysis. The primary analysis is to determine that the appropriate rules and regulations were enacted to create the behavior that the federal government is after. The actual amount of money they spend and what they get for it, I don't think is very often accounted for. And I'm just sitting here thinking, I can't remember of any time it's been accounted for, but that's probably a great overstatement. But generally speaking, no.
Okay. All right. Let's go ahead and take our break right here. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more on the grant and aid funding programs and what this means to our state. More on that with Senator Doug Whitson. Stay with us. Welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show, talking today about the grant and aid funding that comes out of the federal government and how that filters down into the states. And to talk about all that, we're talking with Senator Doug Whitson. He's out of District 28, that's in Southern Oregon. He represents the people of Klamath, Lake, and Crook counties, as well as parts of Jackson and Deschutes counties. You've got either the largest or second largest Senate district.
I think I'm sure it's the second largest Senate district, but it's considerably smaller than Ted Ferriola's. I know that Representative Benz, who represents half of Ted Ferriola's district, has a larger district than I do. So.
Oh, wow. Boy, I bet all three of you guys are pretty glad that gas prices have dropped considerably. So we are talking about the grant and aid funding. This is how the federal government imposes different programs on the states, especially programs that they cannot constitutionally impose. And we were talking about the value of some of these programs and whether or not they're calculated. In the last segment, you said that you don't know that that necessarily figures into that. It's just more a matter of whether or not they followed the rules. And in terms of oversight for this type of funding, what kind of oversight does the state have? Or is this all, or are they basically ceding all oversight power to the federal bureaucrat overseers once the state accepts the funds?
No, I believe the state controls the oversight on how the money is spent, with the caveat that it must be spent following the rules that are created by the federal government. So if certainly if they that are, you know, the rules are created by the federal government to ensure that the money is spent in the way that they want to. The actual spending the money and for a lot of times for this specific program is the allocation of the money is up to the states, but the accounting of that spending and the fact that it is spent according to the rules of rules with Medicaid or with temporary assistance to needy families or to the food stamp or SNAP program. Those all have federal rules that must be maintained. So you can't really spend the money for any other purpose, and you have to spend the money according to the rules that are created by the federal government. But who gets the money individually is up to the states.
So in the last segment, you mentioned that we may be having to give the federal government a refund in terms of some of the funds that they had allocated for the Columbia River Crossing. Does this mean then that we may also be owing the feds some money in terms of Cover Oregon? Because that we got the exchange going, but it never, it's not going now. So does that mean some of those funds are going to have to be paid back?
That's a legal issue that will be decided above my pay grade, but right now it would appear that the state is obligated to pay back a significant amount of money. However, there's the legal minds are working on a sort of what I would call a loophole that might allow Oregon and Nevada to claim that they're actually have a state exchange, even though they both voted to use the federal exchange. I don't know how that's going to work, and probably will depend a lot on by the time that legal action gets to the top of the federal government, who's in charge of the federal government.
In your newsletter, and we'll make sure that we link that up on iSpyRadio.com for this show, and so people can read through that. In that, you mentioned that one-third of the state budget is taken up with federal grant and aid applications. What state agency takes the most the grant and aid funding?
I'm pretty sure it would be the Oregon Health Authority takes the most, because that's all the Medicaid funding. And also the Department of Human Services takes a huge amount of money from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for the food stamp program, and also a great deal of money for the temporary assistance of needy families and other welfare programs. The Transportation Department takes a very significant amount of money from the federal government in there, which is a result of the federal gas tax, which is then distributed to the states. And again, those monies all have rules and regulations that go with them on how the money will be expended and what you have, what hoops you have to jump through in order to get the money and keep it.
You know, a lot of times we hear abuse of these kinds of funds, you know, Bridge to Nowhere and whatnot. And there was an article up on The Blaze that cited another example where in Connecticut, a city received $430,000 to widen sidewalks to fight teen obesity. I'm not sure exactly how widening sidewalks is going to fix that situation. But do you have any examples here in Oregon of that kind of waste that these grant and aid funds are being used for?
There is a little community between Klamath Falls and Lakeview. The town's called Beatty. And it has a sidewalk. It has been built for about, I'd guess, close to a mile, maybe a mile and a quarter on one side of the road, complete with driveways and all that sort of thing. I'm sure someone has walked on that sidewalk sometime, but I can't imagine who or when.
So what happens then if the grant and aid money were to disappear for some of these programs? Do states typically keep that program going, or do they typically just abandon it?
Well, typically they try to keep it going because people have a way of getting used to entitlements. And so if they're used to, having federal money to build highways and having federal money to subsidize Medicaid and all these other things, people tend to like those programs. And so, yes, the states tried to continue them after the federal funding runs out. So you have that problem with the, first of all, a maintenance of effort. That's the one thing that they, in the transition from a regular grant and aid for a full grant and aid to a partial one, then the state is required to maintain an effort to a certain point, and then hopefully when the federal government hopes that when that entire grant and aid program runs out, the state will be on the hook to continue to do the program which the federal government wanted to do in the first place.
Okay, let's take our break right there. Everyone stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking about the problem with all this free money. Welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, talking about the grant and aid program and how federal funds are pushed down to the states in order to enact some various programs that the federal government would like to do, but is not constitutionally able to do. And to do all that, we're talking with Senator Doug Whitsitt out of District 28. He also serves on the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is that the only committee you have this go around, or do you have another one?
That's certainly the only. I have that the Joint Committee and two subcommittees of Ways and Means.
I see. Okay. We were talking in the last segment there about what happens if some of this money was to go away. But on some levels, I think a lot of us might say that might be a good idea, that a lot of these grants were to disappear. I'd like to read, though, something from your newsletter. You said that refusing to take the money ensures that other states that are willing to participate in these kinds of programs will receive the benefits provided by taxpayers living in non-participating states. It seems a little bit like a catch-22 there. I mean, we don't want the strings attached, but you're saying that there are benefits to the funding that other states would get, and that the other states would get those benefits if we held to our principles. So what's your solution on that?
I believe that the grant and aid program that makes up a sixth of their entire federal budget should be greatly reduced, refocused, and with the idea of eliminating it in general. Because the first step to doing that would be to create a general grant and aid program to each state that is you start out with 90% of the money that Oregon is getting now, and leave the strings off of it so the state can spend the money in the way that they best see fit. And then the next, 2 years from now or a year from now, you cut it down to 80 and 70 and so forth and wean them off of those federal programs. It would be very, very difficult for the Oregon, which gets a fourth of its entire budget from the federal government, to go cold turkey and just say, we're not going to take it anymore. And further, the point I was getting at is that if we don't take the money, other states do take the money, and so our tax money simply benefits somebody else's state. Because, this money's not free. It's all coming from either from federal taxes or from federal borrowing that
That's
our
right.
children are going to pay for.
Yep, that's right. So in terms of some programs that might be worthwhile to keep going, do you have some that you would specifically point to that say, this really is probably a good program for the federal government to be funding? For example, like job training programs, educational programs, anything of that nature? Or would you just assume get rid of the entire program, period?
I would like to see the entire grant and aid program phased out over time and the federal government return to their constitutional authorities and let the states do what they do. From the standpoint of probably the most successful grant and aid program has been the Federal Highway Fund. That money is spent to build highways and to build interstates and so forth. It's very useful, and it's something that government should be doing. The federal government does not have the authority to build interstate highways. They have authority to maintain postal roads. But the states have allowed them to build interstates through by giving them providing them a right of way and standing back and watching them build them and giving them authority to do it. So there are some programs that make some sense, certainly, but the ones that are bothering me the most are such are particularly the Environmental Protection Agency, the other agencies that are using grant money to encourage behavior that only the bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. want. But once you get the program going, then, of course, you have all sorts of employees working for it here, and it takes on a life of its own.
That's right. Your newsletter also points out that we're not borrowing money from the feds, but instead are, quote, creating services and bureaucracies that are not being paid from our state revenue. So in essence, we're creating quasi-federal agencies and ceding our state's independence to those. So what's the response of your colleagues there in the Senate? Do they not see this as a problem?
Some do. Again, it seems in political life it's very difficult to get a consensus to turn down free money.
Yes.
But it comes back to the money's not free, and it is being used to manipulate outcomes in a sovereign state that is desirable to some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C.
Of course, the other side of that equation, too, is your constituents. There are farm aid programs. There's all sorts of aid programs for one constituency or another. I mean, how do you then convince the constituents as well that this is not such a great idea?
It's difficult to tell people, just like it is politicians, that free money is not free. But you talk about the farm, let's talk about crop insurance. Originally, crop insurance was put together by the federal government in response to the Dust Bowl in the 30s to encourage people to plant something to try to hold the soil in the ground. And if it did, you know, if it blew away, they would reimburse them for the cost of planting. It is now morphed into a program where you buy crop insurance in order to not only to ensure that you have a certain amount of, you're guaranteeing you not only the yield, but the price. And state and federal taxpayers are paying three-fourths or between two-thirds and three-fourths of the cost of the premium. That's not what it started out to do, and that's a great example to me of what happens to a grant and aid program. It just keeps getting better and better, except for the people who are paying for it, who is the United States taxpayer.
Yeah. We only got about a minute here with you. Just real quick, with the Republican-controlled Congress, do you expect some of these programs to start drying up, and what do you think Oregon will do in response to that?
I very much hope that the Republican Congress will start winnowing down this grant and aid program. And I think Oregon will deal with it like all the rest of the states. They will start taking back their sovereign responsibility and doing what they should do themselves. The fact of the matter is, Mark, many of these grant programs would never be started in the state of Oregon if you had to pay for them with state money.
Absolutely. Absolutely right.
There is the hook. It's just involved.
Yep. All right. Well, Senator Whitson, I want to thank you so much for your time today, and good luck to you in the upcoming legislative cycle.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Coming up next, we'll talk with Kevin Freeman about economic warfare and financial terrorism. Welcome back. This is the I Spy Radio Show. We just finished up our discussion there with Senator Doug Whitsitt talking about grant and aid funding, which is the funding mechanism the federal government uses to spend money in the states, often for special pet projects. We'd like to shift the focus now to a topic once again making the news, economic warfare. And to do that, I'd like to welcome Kevin Freeman, one of the world's leading experts on the issues of economic warfare and financial terrorism. Kevin, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Mark.
Yeah, I'd also like to mention that you've got two books out there, Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack, and Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. Let's maybe start with getting a little bit of an understanding of economic warfare. The dictionary definition of economic warfare is the use of or threat to use economic means against a country in order to weaken its economy and thereby reduce its political and military power. Economic warfare also includes economic means to compel an adversary to change its policies or behavior. We certainly see the U.S. doing this sometimes, or it is also to undermine the ability of another country to conduct normal relations with other countries. A common means of economic warfare that people are probably familiar with include trade embargoes, boycotts, sanctions and tariffs, freezing of capital assets, and so on. And that sort of warfare has been going on for centuries. For example, you know, back in the ancient times when one country would blockade the port of another, that in effect was a type of economic warfare. But the types of economic warfare available to countries or even individuals that you cover in your books are far more sophisticated than blockading a harbor. So talk to our audience about some of the modern-day economic warfare weapons.
Sure. Well, you know, as you mentioned, it has been going on for centuries. In fact, my daughter had an assignment, history assignment, to study the Peloponnesian Wars between Sparta and Athens. And, you know, digging out my sixth grade history, had to find that that it all began with a blockade. Now we could blockade by shutting down the internet of a country.
Yeah.
And in fact, somebody did that to North Korea recently after North Korea hacked into Sony Pictures. At least that's what the FBI says. So when you look at that, you know, the modern day form of blockade could be computer hacking, or it could be shutting down a stock market through manipulative trading, or it could be shutting off the power grid through cyber means or physical means so that the commerce couldn't be conducted. Or it could be draining an economy from any potential growth, which was the target of Osama bin Laden. He wanted to hit us so we would respond back and spend all our money on fighting in the Middle East. These are all forms of economic warfare. They're much more potent than they've ever been in history. And it is really 21st century warfare. It's the main way we fight today.
So is it the purpose of an economic or cyber attack? I mean, is that designed to take over a country, or is it merely to cause havoc, or is it designed as maybe even a preemptive attack prior to a physical invasion?
All of the above. The Russians, before they went into Georgia, used cyber means to take down the government websites and to disrupt communications. So that's the last example. But it could be just an annoyance factor. It could be searching for capabilities. We know that there's a lot of Chinese PLA hacking to understand our industry and how we're going to bid projects and how we, you know, price things. So that's a form of economic warfare. And, of course, there is the economic warfare where you literally attempt to shut down an entire economy and punish them. Or as the Iranians found out, a Stuxnet virus could be applied to try and shut down a nuclear facility or nuclear development program.
So what are some of the warning signs of an actual attack? I mean, and what distinguishes a coordinated attack from, say, like a normal run on the market where people see a sell-off making the news and it just snowballs?
You know, it's really hard. The thing about cyber that's so valuable to the one using it is it's stealthy. It's really hard to find out true attribution of who's responsible for something. And so if North Korea hacked into Sony, somebody did, and the FBI says it was North Korea. Some others disagree, but they were there for a long time. Somebody was in the bowels of J.P. Morgan for a long time. It's hard to tell who's doing it. And how do you distinguish when you see something? It's virtually impossible. The Department of Homeland Security, the New York Stock Exchange, the FBI, everybody looked at what was known as the flash crash of the stock market in I think it was May of 2010, and nobody knows exactly what the cause of it. But everyone agrees it could have been a cyber attack, and we just aren't able to trace it.
Well, speaking of crashes, in your book, Secret Weapons, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, you actually analyzed the 2008 stock market crash. What was the lead up to that crash?
We were extraordinarily vulnerable in 2007, 2008, because we had a housing bubble, and we had a lot of bad subprime loans. We had some bad government policies surrounding those, some, you know, encouraging people to take loans that shouldn't have, some where we didn't even regulate what Warren Buffett called financial weapons of mass destruction, which he was referring to credit default swaps, you know, a really complex Wall Street term used only at the highest levels in finance. But right now it's known as a credit derivative. And a derivative is something that's derived from something else. Literally, these are bets on housing, the stock market, and so forth.
Right.
The bets on those things are measured in the hundreds of trillions of dollars, but credit default swaps were unregulated completely. Nobody was looking at them. So those are the kind of things that led up to putting us in a position of vulnerability. And then I believe what happened was that vulnerability was exploited as a means of economic warfare.
All right, let's go ahead and take a break right there. Everyone stay with us. We're going to have more on the very real threat of economic warfare with Kevin Freeman, one of the nation's leading experts on financial terrorism. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We are talking to Kevin Freeman today. We are talking about economic warfare and financial terrorism. He's the author of Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack, and also of Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. And speaking of the U.S. stock market and how that was brought down, we kind of left it as a cliffhanger there. Could you talk to us about those vulnerabilities and how those were exploited?
Sure. In 2007, there were groups in the Middle East that were following Sharia-compliant investing that looked for opportunities to short sell American banks. And I know that gets complicated, but short selling is where you're really betting on a stock to go down rather than go up. And how you normally do it is you borrow shares, you sell them, and then if it goes down, you buy them back and replace the borrowed shares. What happened in 2007 was called naked short selling, and literally people were dumping counterfeit shares of Lehman Brothers and all the big banks onto the market right as everybody was panicking. And that exacerbated the decline tremendously. It forced us into a bailout position. And it really was, it was something that had been talked about in the literature dating back to a book the Chinese wrote called Unrestricted Warfare in 1999, how to take down a country without firing a shot. It was referred to in a lot of Islamic writings and Sharia-compliant writings. It was radical means of attacking America without America knowing it. And it took place in, I document it all in the book Secret Weapon, and there's no doubt that there were people trying to take down our stock market when we were the most vulnerable we were.
A lot of people have heard of counterfeit dollars, obviously, but how do you counterfeit a share?
You call your stockbroker and tell them that you've got shares of XYZ company, and then you just don't deliver them.
But then how is that not traceable back to those people that were counterfeiting those, or was it traced back to them?
In part it was, in part it wasn't. It's called a failure to deliver, and our system is not set up to really track those other than we know who sold them, and when they were sold, they could have been sold by a big dark pool, which obscures your ability to see who was behind the trade. It was just, and we've got the data on it, and there were some investigations, and there were limited punishments handed out, but it took 6 years to get to that point.
Wow.
It was such a mass panic. And if you sold it and then you, quote, covered it within a day or two, there's no record of whether those shares were ever really real. You create the panic by calling, 100 million shares of Lehman were short sold in the week of September 11th, 2008, and they were covered fairly quickly thereafter. But once you've started that panic rolling, it's almost impossible to go back and say who was dealing fairly and who wasn't.
That failure to deliver loophole there, has that vulnerability been covered? I mean, have we addressed that as a nation?
Not really. We have. It's been acknowledged that it's a problem.
Wow.
But it continues today to be a problem.
Wow. Also, within that 2008 crash, in your book, you talk about how the Russians actually, this was an active attack by them, that they were dumping the U.S. bond holdings in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and actually tried to get China to buy in on that. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. Right as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were in trouble, the Russians took tens of billions of dollars of holdings that they had, and they called the Chinese and said, we will dump these holdings. Please join us in dumping it, and we can bankrupt Fannie and Freddie and force the Treasury to bail them out and maybe bankrupt America. And China, we know that because the Chinese told our Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson, during the Summer Olympics that was taking place. Now, when that was first brought out, people were shocked at that. But if you look at what Vladimir Putin and Russia are doing now to undermine the dollar in the treasury, then it just seems very normal now. At the time, it was shocking.
Well, and what was our response to that? Did we ever do anything back to them?
Well, our response is we've entered a global economic war, and Russia's, you know, on the recipient of American sanctions, and we're doing all kinds of things that are undermining the Russian economy and the ruble. The ruble's collapsing as we speak, and that is in large part because of actions taken by the United States and Saudi Arabia and others. So it's a global economic war, and it's taking place right now.
So in terms of the Chinese, though, people might look at that and say, well, it just seems so horrific to even think of that. But as you mentioned, they published that manual, Unrestricted Warfare, and we'll make sure that we link that up on our website, iSpyRadio.com. But within that, I guess the question becomes for people, okay, so why would China want to unleash this when destroying us would be killing their best customer?
And there's a valid point there. But you've got to keep in mind, China is no more monolithic than the United States. You know, to an outsider, well, the United States is doing this, and they'll say, well, they're through the NSA, they're monitoring everything. Well, it's not the entire United States. There's differing elements. We have Republicans, we have Democrats, liberals, and conservatives, and progressives. We have a Defense Department. We have business people. So the Chinese businessman certainly does not want to do anything that would harm the American economy. But inside the Chinese military, and they're the ones that published this book, Unrestricted Warfare, there are very belligerent elements who believe that the 21st century should be the China century, and they're willing to suffer casualties and blowback if it destroys America and puts China on top. So much so that in 2005, a leading general in China said that it would be indeed difficult to kill 100 million Americans, but if it was necessary to do so to ensure the China century, we might have to do it.
Wow. Scary stuff. All right, we're getting close to a break here, so let's go ahead and do that. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Kevin Freeman, one of the world's leading experts on financial terrorism. Stay with us. Welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're into our final segment now, talking to Kevin Freeman. He is one of the world's leading experts on the issues of economic warfare and financial terrorism. He has a couple of books out there that we'll make sure that we link up on iSpyRadio.com. Just find today's show page, and we'll have links to those books. And I'd also, you know, going into the break there, we were talking about the attacks by China, and I think a lot of people are saying, well, maybe this is somewhat mitigated. The potential for attack, anyway, is somewhat mitigated by our strong grip on the international banking system and even by our allies, as well as the threat of repercussions against any country that decides to attack us. So what are your thoughts on that? Are we fairly safe, or what's the real level of threat here?
Yeah, the reality of it is, while we're the strongest player in terms of the ability to conduct financial cyber economic warfare, there's no doubt we have the strongest capabilities. We're also the most vulnerable of nations. We're more dependent on the electric grid than the vast majority of countries. We're more dependent on the internet than the vast majority of countries. We're more dependent on the stock market. So we're more vulnerable than any other country. If we were to take out the Russian stock market tomorrow, and they were to take out the New York Stock Exchange tomorrow, it would hurt us far more than it would hurt them in response. This is different from mutually assured destruction. With nuclear weapons, you wipe out Washington and Moscow, and both nations are suffering horrifically. With this, you wipe out the internet capability of Moscow and the internet capability of New York, and we suffer far more. So this is a very serious threat. And unfortunately, while we're seeing it as a toy and a weapon that we can use, there's almost an arrogance in the nation that's ignoring how vulnerable we are. Juan Zarate was a Treasury Department official in the Bush administration, and he wrote a book about all the weapons we have, but his last chapter is very plain. It says we're more vulnerable than any other nation. And individuals have a responsibility to protect themselves, because right now the government isn't creating the capability of protecting them.
So you're talking about the vulnerability of the structures within our markets and our economy. I'd like to start connecting the dots for our people out there. In the first half of our show, we talked with Oregon State Senator Doug Whitsitt about grant and aid spending by the federal government, which amounts to about $650 billion per year. The only way we can really sustain those kind of government giveaways is to essentially borrow it. And after years of this, the United States is in a very precarious financial situation. Our total federal debt right now is about 107% of GDP. So does all of that debt and spending make us even more vulnerable?
Oh, absolutely. One of my real nightmare scenarios is that the dollar, which is extremely strong right now, all of a sudden is no longer desired by the nations of the world for trade. And that we're moving that direction and on the demand, basically, of Vladimir Putin and China and a few other nations. Brazil and Uruguay just signed an agreement. They're no longer going to trade in dollars. If we can't finance our debt externally by selling it to foreigners, then where do we finance it? We have to either sell it internally, where we have no savings rate as a nation, relatively speaking, or we sell it to the Federal Reserve, and they just print money to pay that debt. That is a prescription for absolute disaster. We're not there yet, but as we rack up more and more debt, we become increasingly vulnerable. And we're vulnerable on the cyber side, too. And that's something that just recently came out with the CENTCOM Twitter feed hack. One of my friends is the president of the American Bankers Association. He was in with the Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew, recently with a couple of very powerful bank presidents. And they asked the Treasury Secretary, what is your nightmare scenario? And he says, what if you wake up and there's no record of your bank account?
Yeah.
Well, those are the kind of vulnerabilities.
And that's actually a great point, because a lot of people look at this and say, well, don't they have backups for this sort of thing? I mean, isn't there like a daily backup that shows what you had at least yesterday? You know, maybe not, you know, current up to the moment, but they at least have some idea on this.
What if the backup gets hacked? Hey, we found at J.P. Morgan that the hackers were there for not days, but weeks and months. It's the same thing if your personal computer gets hacked and you're just continuing to back up that virus in the backup, you can't clean it and get it back. So it really is much more complicated than the simple, oh, I have a backup, I'll just restore it. There is no carbonite for all of the federal government and everything that we have. And even if you have carbonite and people have used it, you know, it's real nice to have an offline in the cloud backup. It just takes a long time to restore. What happens if it's not just your computer, but it's the entire financial system? The restoration process would be horrendous.
So we got about a little under 2 minutes here. Is anyone in the federal government taking this seriously? You seem to indicate not. But I mean, if they were to take this seriously, what do they need to do in order to protect us?
We have a Defense Department and a Central Command that is a war-fighting capable machine. They really understand warfare. And yet, sloppy cyber practices, probably cyber hygiene, probably cost them a huge public relations nightmare when CENTCOM is hacked and they're putting out tweets about ISIS. What do we need to do? We need to take it seriously by making it a national priority. We can't just assume that the government's got it handled, so individuals need to prepare. They need to keep copies of their bank records and stock brokerage statements and, you know, hard copy things. They need to keep a certain amount of food and water on hand in case that there are supply disruptions, in case somebody hacks in and changes the chemical mix of the water supply. They need to do all kinds of things at the individual level. The government needs to have not just a cyber command that defends our nation against these kind of attacks, but we need to actually have a public-private meeting of the minds where we understand what it means. It used to be in World War II, loose lips sink ships, and we warned people about giving over in espionage, giving away information. We need to take this seriously and have some type of a citizen involvement to address it.
All right. Scary stuff for sure. Kevin, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
You know, that's really amazing stuff and shocking, really, to think how our leaders have put all of us in such a dangerous spot. And they haven't even fixed some of the holes. The simple fact is, the more we spend, the more vulnerable we become. And the states are going to have to take control on this because the federal government is completely out of control. This show will be available for a free download by Monday at noon. Here's a thought. Copy the link to the show and send it to your state representative and senator. Ask them to listen to it and let them know you want action. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.